drink and no health insurance. This is before the Obamacare started. So they did something. Typically, when a community is hit with an issue or a problem, this retraining happens. It's not, you don't get something like what you like to do or what you want to do. It's retraining or something like instruction, things like that. So we came in, and what they wanted to do was find some other way during that off season that they could have, you know, be involved with fishing. At that exact same time, the BP oil spill happened, and there they were without that other 6 months. They couldn't get out of the Gulf. So we happened to find something referencing Asian carp, this fish that was out in the lodge. We thought, oh, you know, maybe this is it. Long story short, she and I, developing our research, focused populations, we started to think about what Asian carp might do for this group. We wrote a business plan. At that time, BP said, well, we're going to start to reimburse everybody. So just at the point we're ready to launch this thing, which was, getting people involved in fishing for Asian carp in the Mississippi, that group and many others had to show that they couldn't work. They were impacted so much by the oil spill that they could not work. So here we were with a pretty well-developed business plan, connections made, fish supply gotten, and we couldn't activate it unless we took it on ourselves. So we basically started a fish company in our living room with trying to do Asian carp at nights, working at our universities during the day. And so that was our very humble beginning. We got no money from anybody else. This was all, and still is, kind of our own, we operate from our own revenue. But we came at it from a different angle. The angle was not that this is an invasive crab species we want to blow out of the water and get rid of, which is still the ongoing way. This is actually the best fish in the world. In the world. There's very few wild-caught fish anywhere. Some are maybe a bunch in the ocean, but everything else is farmed. There's really no traceability. There's farms everywhere around the world. Actually, these fish happen to be farmed. They're only in the U.S. wild caught, and they grow to such a large extent. So everywhere else in the world, the fish are about this big. They're in farms and they're caught, and it's a really cheap source of protein. Here, they grow very large in very clean environments. They're very high in omega-3 fatty acids. They have very high protein, and those two criteria are very similar to wild-caught salmon. There aren't many of those around anymore. So we have something that is high in omega-3 fatty acids, is very, very clean, is high in protein, and is wild-caught, and is entirely sustainable, because they're everywhere. They're invasive, but that can be a very positive thing. So that is what we don't hear a lot. We hear a lot of, we want to get rid of them, we hate those fish, war on carp, all those kinds of things. But this is a tremendous resource we have in the U.S. So that's the way we've gone about building our company. And our products are really geared toward very healthy, natural kinds of things that are usually in those same products, which she'll describe in a sec, loaded with chemicals in other options are loaded with chemicals and not very healthy, although they're quite widespread, especially in the Asian communities.
So when we say that they're high in omega-3, on par with wild-caught salmon, high in fish protein, no lead, no mercury, those are actual data that we have. My background is in, I have a PhD in nutritional sciences, so as part of we took about 13 months to put together this business plan, where we researched the fish, we sent it to other labs to make sure that they were finding the same thing that we were finding to validate what we were discovering. And what we realized is part of, I think we put on probably over 100,000 miles on my Camry, traveling all over. We would meet fishermen, we would meet shrimpers. It was sort of an academic approach. You want to be methodical, you want to have rigorous, the same thing that we've been taught. But what we realized was sort of, you can be in your ivory tower and theoretically, write up a grand scheme, but when you come to actually getting a workforce or employment or, doing that, it's a whole different arena. So we've had to learn in the past 9 years now quite a lot in terms of what academic didn't teach you. And what we've discovered was that, you know, this fish is just a phenomenal resource that we have. But just because the mainstream Americans aren't familiar with eating bones and fish doesn't mean it's a trash fish. We get a lot of people coming to say, oh, this is such a horrible fish, you know. And since we ask them, have you ever eaten it? No, I've never eaten it. I like catfish. That's a scavenger on the bottom of the river. Or you're eating a farm, you know, farm, because fish meal is so expensive now, they've resorted to using, you know, the USDA recently approved wood chips, fish meal. So we're eating fish that are being fed wood, or you're, now they're being fed, you know, soy fish meal. The problem with soy fish meal is, yeah, that's a lot better than wood, but soy, we have to eat fish, or the fish has to eat other fish in order to make omega-3. We as humans can't make omega-3, but when you eat a lot of soy, you're making a lot of omega-6 and omega-9, which humans, we make a lot of that. So the health consequences of now eating something where we're going to be adding more omega-6, more omega-9 to our body compared to omega-3, what does that mean? We probably won't know until our children find out for us. So there's a lot of things out there, and customers or fish eaters, or when we go to the grocery store, we are a lot more sophisticated now. We're asking questions. Where is this caught? Who's making it? Who produces? Even, you know, the more questions we ask, the more people are realizing that you can't just simply ship a fish and put it on the plate and people are going to eat it. People want to know where it's coming from, which makes this fish sort of the perfect opportunity for us to reintroduce the American palate to a fish that is in our backyard, that's well caught, all natural, traceable. When you eat our product, you know down to the person, the staff who sealed that package and put that in the box for you. If you call us up and you say, hey, I have this fish at this restaurant on this day, can you tell me the fisherman that you got it from? Yes, I can. Can you do that with a wild-caught salmon? Probably not, because that caught, it may have been caught in the U.S. by fishermen, commercial fishermen in the U.S., but it was shipped over to China to process and then shipped back to us. Same thing with other carp processor now. I know I'm all over the place right now in terms of what I'm talking about. There's just a lot of information. I know I'm talking about the product. So in terms of, you know, there's a few other carp processors in the space, but what they're doing is they're just taking whole fish and they're shipping it overseas. Now, most likely that's gonna be coming back to us either for pet food or in form for fish meal that we're buying it to feed catfish or whatever. So what we thought about was, rather than shipping whole fish, which we try, and it just, while there's a lot of this fish, there's not a lot of people who know how to catch it. And there's not a, you know, just because they jump out of the water doesn't mean that just because you have a boat out there, all of them are gonna jump into your boat and you're gonna have enough to handle your business. You'd be surprised how
the fish are free because they jump into the boats.
We had many people in China who said that to us.
You get them free, they jump in your boat.
So what we figured was that people, given the way that the new customers and the sophistication that they have now, and they want convenience, but they also want something that's all natural. So we basically had a moment in which this was August, I think it was August 17 of 2011. We had just, he and I had just dumped, I think 10 tons of fish in the landfill in Appaloosa, because the contract that we had, the people decided they weren't going to fulfill their end. So we had to get rid of these fish. That was 10 ton in the heat of Louisiana in the summer. So we sat in the living room and thinking, we are out of our place, out of our mind. You know, we have good jobs. Why are we doing this? And I think, you know, the smart thing was, let's just get rid of this and let's get a good night's sleep and just go back to our, you know, research life. And being a researcher, part of that is you're crazy to begin with, and you don't give up. So we said, no, we're not going to give up. We're going to figure out what to do. We pour all of our money into this. We pour all this time into this. And everybody in our family and friends think we're crazy, so we're not going to let them think that they're right. So what do we do? And I, everybody said imitation crab meat.
Yeah.
So imitation crab meat is made from what's called surimi, which is like a fish paste. So they take a fish, so the, every Asian culture has their own version of how to make this. They take the fish, usually it's a very bony fish, they use a spoon, they scrape out all the meat, and then they pound the crap out of it until it becomes, think of a really sticky pizza dough. And then from that, they put it with flour, with garlic, and things like that, and then they make like fish balls or fish cakes. So it was a way to preserve your protein if you didn't have refrigeration. So in 1969, the Japanese figured out a way to cryogenically freeze this when they're out in the ocean, and using a machinery that basically, think of a washing machine, they catch a lot of pollock, they throw it in this washing machine, it basically pulverizes, and then it pulls out all the scales, all the blood, and it leaves like a mush and then a meat. And then from that mush, they add a lot of chemicals to make it white and to make it tasty and all of that. So that's how surimi is made. And then they figured out to make imitation crab meat by making it, you know. So anyway, it is made only in the ocean or by the ocean because the amount of water that's required to pull out all of the blood and all of the scale is so much pollutant in there that only the water from the ocean or the current can kind of get rid of that. You can't make it inland, at least on an industrial size, unless you have enough money to build yourself a water treatment plant. I grew up hating eating these products because they were always smells, and I'm allergic to MSG and all kinds of things. So I turned to him and I said, we're gonna make surimi. And he didn't know what surimi was. And I called up my mom, and she laughed. She said,
not in a supportive way.
Yes. And so she said, you cannot, first you hate eating it when you were growing up. You would only eat it if I made it. There's so many people out there making this. And it can't be made from a car because it can only be made from an ocean fish. So whatever my mom says, I can't do something, I'm gonna do it. So for the next 6 or 8 months, I spent time figuring out how to make this. And we wanted to make it all natural from beginning to end. No chemicals, no trisodium phosphate, not even MSG. And we were gonna make it natural and we were gonna make it convenient so that I come home hard from a day's work, I can just take it out of my freezer or fridge, put it in the microwave, and it is going to be just like I spent the whole day making it. I don't know how I was going to do that, but we were going to do it. And we started with a spoon, and we figured out how to cut certain things, and we would sit there and we would scrub to get our pile of boneless meat. So after about 6 months or so, we had sort of a prototype. I sent it to my mom to have her taste it. And she actually said, I can't believe you got it. But that was just, my mother never says things like that. You know Asian moms, they never say things like that. So then she gave it to a friend of hers who was a food broker in Chicago. She called us about a week later and said, I would like 300 pounds of this, please. We literally killed ourselves.
We're still working here today.
We were still doing 10 to 12 hours at the hospital and the university, teaching and researching, and then coming back and driving to Simport, which is 3 hours away from New Orleans, to pick up fish and do this. So we finally did give her 300. And she called back and she says, hey, can I get 1,700 pounds? No. So we figure out that people really like this because it was so different from what was being offered. When you walk into an Asian grocery store, there are so many of this that's imported from China, Thailand, and all that. And if you look at the ingredients, it is like this long and of chemical names only. You know, you don't even know what fish is from. On ours, you have carp, you've got garlic, you've got salt, you've got shallots, you know, things that you recognize. And people really like that. And so what we realized was that we can't do it ourselves. There's no way we can make 1,700 pounds of this. But we also realized during trying to figure out how to do this, in our work in the community, we had worked with a lot of groups that that were set up to help find jobs. So I had this call from a woman's shelter, and she said that, hey, I've got this lady, she's just gotten out of jail from domestic violence, and she really needs a job. She's really emotional and raw, can you help? So I said, sure, I'll meet with her. And Lilia was just out of jail. I mean, she didn't know anything about fish. And I said, look, I've got a little money, and this is the only job that I can find for you right now if you don't want to be around a lot of people. So she said, okay, I'll take it. So with Lilia on board, we were able to meet some of that 1,700 pound order. But she really took to the job and really really flourished and helped us figure it out. And then she said, hey, can you hire other people? Because I knew I have this other woman that's in there, and she has this situation. Can we also help her? And so we realized that we could use this as a way to help other people. We didn't know what we were doing because we weren't ready to give up our academic job at that time, but we also realized that this was a way to help other people. And so with the money that we got from the sale, we basically ended up by the time 2013 came around, we had a team of seven women and two men. And those two men was Miguel, which is Lilia's son, who needed a part-time job in college, and her brother, who just came over from Mexico to find a better job. So it was really an incredible feeling, what we were able to do. And it was a lot more fun than being an academic. So long story short, in the meantime, I forgot to mention, we also figured out, somebody said to John that, you know, you figure out how to make boneless filet from it, then you could barely make it big.
When you're starting a business, everybody knows much better than you, and nobody hesitates to. And so you spend most of your time with anyone you meet, they telling you. So we were working with this group of shrimpers down there because they had lost all their shrimp. So we wanted to replace it with Asian carp. They sort of had a workforce. So we came in with
$500,000
together with Grant. We got the fish, we got the training, but still they knew better. So the owner, who had been bankrupted twice, he said to me, the only way you're gonna, you know, make profit or you're gonna survive is if you can make this a boneless filet. So we did. You know, we cut a billion fish between the two of us, and once you know the anatomy of the fish, it's, you know, and you spend enough time and you have that impetus behind you, you come up with how to make boneless filets. Those who are coming to the dinner tonight will have those. So it really was that which forced us to do it. But we also found that, so the surimi is one part of the fish, boneless filets are another. There's the whole rest of that fish. So the more you do most parts of that fish, the more, you know, the more offers you have the products, but it also makes it something where you're not just throwing a bunch of stuff into the landfill.
We always wanted to be a zero processor. From our research, that was the way you can maximize your profit, but also we were very mindful of what was going back into the environment. A lot of people, you know, if you go on the website, they'll cut like little strips of it, and then they basically just throw the fish. And then they still have this horrible law, because it's invasive, that if you catch the fish in your net or if it jumps on your boat, you can't throw it back. Well, I should say this is in Kentucky only. You can't throw it back into the water. So you know what happens with sports fishermen and boaters or fishermen? They just throw it on land and leave it to rot so then children can't come by and enjoy the park because it's just rotting there. But that makes no sense to us. So little by little, we became zero waste. We found out that the red meat and the skin were great as pet treats. And there were companies that, boutique companies that were willing to buy that. You know, we supply Bark Box, we supply to Scouts and Zoe, Wild Ones. So those we could sell. Even the bladders, you know.
These are the air bladders.
Did you know that they use that in beer? You didn't know that, did you? So they air bladder from fish. What? No, it is.
No, I know.
Okay. It goes in beers, and then also it's really good in soup and stir fry, but it requires quite a bit of processing. A pound of dry fish maw or fish bladder can go between $19 to $50-something. It is a pain in the tush to process, but you can do that. And dogs, oh my gosh, they love chewing on that because it's pure collagen. And we had a lot of friends who had older dogs, and it really helped them to, you know, for their joints and things like that, and it's just beautiful in their fur. So we were able to do this, and then we found out that there was a rendering company in Mississippi who would buy the remaining carcass and head, because these are big heads, and they would, if we bring it to them on our way to pick up fish, we, you know, they will make that into fish meal. So basically a fish that, you know, we pay the most in the space. Right now I think the average price is between 8 cents and 10 cents. We pay double that amount, if not triple, depending on the size of the fish for what we need. But they have to ice it and they have to maintain it for human consumption. So
just the challenge of the catching. Doesn't respond to hook or bait because it's, you know, it's a filter feeder, so it's only gill nets, and, you know, so that means it's only commercial fishermen. And commercial fishermen up and down the Mississippi, their main thing is spoon, you know, the spoonbill season for the egg. So spoonbill season is a big, that's where many people make most of their money. The second is buffalo. Catfish is kind of a third, but there's no market anywhere for Asian carp. So even if fishermen wanted to catch it, there's no market for them except for people like us. Two Rivers, another company which is nearby where we are, that's Chinese owned, they just ship whole fish, so they don't pay a lot for them. And they don't have any real product that they give. They'll cut the heads off, they'll do the bladders too, but it's not really a product that you can sell in the US. So fishermen are, they're being enticed and, there's initiatives to pay extra for them catching the fish, but boy, there's no place for them to go because there is no market. So we have been up and down the Mississippi all these years finding particular fishermen, and there are some that, you know, talk a good game. That's how we ended up in Kentucky from Louisiana, is because a fisherman really convinced us that up in Kentucky there's all that water, there's all this fish, you're going to do well there. We rarely get fish from Kentucky because the fishermen don't fish for what we're looking for. And in fact, they fish very little. We get most of our stuff down south where we were, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas. So we made this move not for nothing. We ended up in Paducah, which is a great place. We have a great workforce. But, you know, we travel to get our fish. I travel down to Mississippi to drop off our scrap. So the fishing side is a whole undeveloped industry. There is no supply chain. We have to build that ourselves. The product side, there are no products except what we've developed. A lot of people have tried to do surimi, but because of the wastewater problem, because we do it a very different way, the old kind of traditional way with big machinery, that makes it viable for us. So, we don't share that with anybody. Boneless fillets, everybody understands a fillet. Fewer understand surimi, so we get a lot of pressure to make fillets, but boy, I can only make them from large fish, and it's only a portion of the fish that we can make them from. You got to have, you know, this kind of broad, you know, product plan to use the rest of the fish. So there's the, you know, the supply side, which is entirely undeveloped, except what we've done for ourselves. And then there's the product side, which is brand new. And we're not saying, hey, man, this is an invasive species, you got to eat it, but like make, you know, give, you're giving lemons, make lemonade. That's a bad message that you're giving people. Like I said in the very beginning, this is the best fish in the world. That's the business case and the reason for eating it. Getting that out against the whole flow of people banging, you know, this war on carp I mentioned, a website of a group in Kentucky, they're looking to eradicate. Nobody's looking to really take advantage of this. So so those challenges are what we, as a very small company, but well, we employ 18 people, the small company that we're doing all those at once, you know, it costs a bit of money and it takes a little effort to do it, but we feel that, you know, this is, you know, we're not doing it as a cause. We really feel that this is a wonderful resource for the USA, and it is, we're trying to build a model for this workforce that she alluded to earlier. We had an entire group in some of our development years, of people coming out of drug court. Actually, that has sort of transitioned out, although we still have some, and a new group has transitioned in, not by anything we did, it just was something that sort of naturally occurred. So everyone now in our workforce are people who are coming out of prison. So they spent years in prison, mostly from drugs. And we have relapses.
Oh, murder.
Or that.
We don't ask.
Yeah,
whatever your past is, once you walk in this door, it's your past. We just ask that you don't talk about your past with other people. Like, you know, some people like to share stories. We ask that you focus on the work and you get a good pay for it. We pay people the living wage. At one point, we had won an award through Village Capital, and we were evaluated by the B Corporation, which is a beneficial corporation. Companies like Ben & Jerry is a B Corp. And we went through all of that, and our scores were very high. And so one of the things is that you give people a living wage. A lot of people coming out of the criminal justice system are immediately hit with a lot of fees that they have to pay. And oftentimes a lot of people don't wanna hire them. And so the only sort of job that's available are the ones at the fast food place.
Sure.
And unfortunately, those are the same place that got them into trouble in the first place. So our space, this, you know, we pay people a living wage. We simply ask that, you know, they don't talk about their past. They show up to work. We have a great relationship with the Halfway House in Paducah. The director and us, we have a, you know, we talk a lot, and we, you know, we've learned a lot. Is that there's a trust that these men or women come to us, and we, you know, we don't kind of go back and tell the director what they're doing or exactly, you know, but if there's signs that, and we've been doing this enough that you start to see signs when someone starts to go back to their past. So we have some concerns, and so we'll say, hey, you know, we may have a couple of positions open. If you know, and that's usually the key for the Halfway House people or the council or the parole officers to kind of start to be vigilant of their ward. But we have a good group of men right now. That you know, they show up on time, they do the work, they're mindful of all of the FDA regulations that they have to follow. It's a good workforce because they're highly motivated to make money so that they can get their own place out of the Halfway House, or to pay back the fees, or and they're being supervised by the Halfway House and by their parole officer. So it's not like they're dangerous people, you know, they're just trying to, no one's perfect, they're just trying to live their life, a new chapter in their life. So we make these, we do about 15 to 20,000 pounds of carp every week. We do about 3 to 4,000 pounds of these fish cakes that we we completely sell. We never have inventory. If you want to know what they taste like, have you ever eaten bologna? So mortadella, the way that people make mortadella is very similar to the way we make these fish cake. So they've got that little bite to it, but when we can produce enough, we will be taking them mainstream and introducing it as pescatarian ham, because that's really what they are.
Mainstream. So, yeah, like the main river, the mainstream.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think, you know, obviously one thing that's true of all of the panels today is looking at this intersection of ecology, economy, and community, right? And how to negotiate those sort of intersections, right, and overlaps, when often they're sort of kept apart or even put in oppositional sort of positions to each other. And so I guess, given your depth of experience now in trying to operate in this space where you're trying to work with different kinds of communities, ecologies, economies that, you know, again, aren't given to you, you really have to develop them yourself. What's the next thing to work towards? Like, what's your biggest challenge or biggest opportunity that you see for your Fin Gourmet right now?
Well, we both have made a commitment to go in this full time a few years ago, so we're no longer an academic. We definitely want to grow this business. It's sort of become our baby. What we want to do is we recognize this intersection, as you mentioned. You can't get rid of this fish. There's just too much of it. And I mean, the biomass is the same as ocean fish, or what's left of ocean fish. So you can't get rid of it. But what you can do is you can manage it. It's not a monster. All it's doing is filter feeding all of the zooplankton, the nutrients that other fish need in order to grow to a size that they can reproduce. So I'll get to your question in just a second. So we can manage it and also perhaps even work with organizations like the Lower Mississippi River Consortium and other environmental groups to do other conservations to our inland waterways. But what we also realize is we can also come into communities where there may have been, you know, where there's a lot of racism or discriminations and et cetera, and provide a safe environment that's pay well and to perhaps revitalize that community. The place that we're at is in South Paducah, Southside Paducah. I remember when I got there, people would say to me, oh, you're in the ghetto area. To us, it's just a place that needs more business, more attention to. But people are good, people want decent jobs. They don't want to hand, you know, to give them something. They want a job and they want to be able to earn it. So this intersection that you mentioned, what we realize is from this fish, we can give people a good job, therefore help to grow the community, and in return, manage the environment and the ecosystem. The ecosystem is changing. Whether you like it or not, it's changing. This fish is a disruptor. You can throw it in the landfill, add more to your waste, ruin parks that people can't enjoy, or you can use it and make a better community to live with and benefit. And so that's sort of our take on it. You know, lots of people, they ship it away. You know, you can talk about the carbon footprint and all of this. We have worked hard to make this a fish that is nutritious and delicious. We've recently been certified by the James Beard Foundation as a smart catch protein source. This fish has been at the James Beard House twice, and been at the White House the previous administration. You know, chefs really like it, and it's good for people. You know, people say, oh, you know, you're pregnant or you're elderly, you shouldn't really eat a lot of fish because of the mercury or the lead. This fish doesn't have any. So it's really safe for the different life phases that we all have.
What's the question?
I'm sorry, you had a question.
Yes. Hard to
you can do a lot. Like, there's a lot of research now where using the skin to help third-degree burns rather than using, you know, bandages and things like that. The skin heals much faster with using fish. There are several research publications that have shown using certain types of tilapia skin helps. You know, absolutely the collagen, but in terms of the process, and then the omega-3 from this fish is just phenomenal. I mean, on a regular day, when you go through our small space of processing, at the end of the day, the floor, it's just like someone spilled oil all over it. And that's from just simply cutting the fish. So the rendering company that we work with, I know they also press the what we give them for omega-3. So there are certainly, as we grow, we want to be able to connect with other industries to, but to get to, like, you want, you know, like the omega-3 market oil. The price depends on the quality of the how you press it, just like olive oil, for example. Same thing about collagen. So we as a company can't do all of that, but by connecting and the more people understand the value and what the and the benefit of this fish, then we hope that they will, you know, come to us and say, hey, we'd like to buy your, you know, if you know a company, I'm more than happy. I've got 22 boxes in my freezer right now. Yes. Right, so it's like it's a filter feeder. So it stays on the top of the water, and it has a huge amount of gill system. And so it's just pulling in water so that it traps the zooplankton that's coming through. So those are the tiny microorganisms that fingerlings feed on so that they can grow to a certain size and so that they can reproduce. So what's happening is an Asian carp will reach, you know, this size, which is reproducible within 10 to 12 months. No, those aren't really huge. But by the time they're about 15 pounds, they're able to reproduce. So if you think about it, one female will spawn about 3 times a year, and that's probably about 1 million eggs. And a quarter of that will survive to become that. So in 12 months, a quarter carp will now be able to reproduce, so that multiply that. So that's why there's so much of it. It's not, and it's jumping out because it's staying on the top. So when a boat goes by, the electricity or static, and it causes it to jump, and it can injure people. I have scars from that. Right, but a 40 pounder can't really jump. That's gravity is not going to allow that. But a small, what I call a teenager, well, and they can, and you see very impressive photo pictures of them jumping all over, but that's because wildlife fishery will go in and shock that space. And it's not shocking just the carp, it's shocking other fish as well. So there's a tendency by our government to go in to try to save a place, but end up hurting many other things as well without, you know, any consequences to them except to the community that's living there. Yes.
I think what you've done is really heroic. And I think it was a spur. I mean, you know, the first way I heard about it was as this terrible thing that's happening. And I love your attitude and what you've done, and I've eaten the fillets and the fish cakes, and the fillet is but I mean, they're all fantastic. We love the fish cake. But I want to know specifically what waters are your fish coming from? Because it's, I mean, the Mississippi, I don't think of as very clean.
ask you why you think the Mississippi is not very clean?
Because I don't know. And
okay.
I guess it's like it has so much traffic.
Right.
And I know in the southern part, there's a lot of industry.
Mm-hmm. So that's one of the biggest myths that people, that when we talk to chefs or regular people, they say to us, wow, it's just so dirty.
Yeah.
And all of the farm runoffs and all of that. Bless you. I'm not contagious.
But I am.
Oh, boy. So the thing you have to understand, no matter what the current administration tries to do, the Clean Water Act has really done an amazing job to in terms of managing that waterway. And the Mississippi is such a huge body of water, and it's always moving. And so that really helps quite a bit. What we actually found was in they go in and they build like at the lake in the village lake. No, where there's not a lot of water exchange, the fish doesn't taste very good.
Oh. Where there's lots.
Yeah, there's the lakes that get, they're horseshoe lakes that used to be part of the river get closed off.
Okay.
They
right.
never
yeah.
get replenished
yeah.
with the water.
Right.
Fish stay, they don't taste great. We need, it needs a...
running water.
Yeah,
exactly.
It needs some kind of water.
So we,
yeah.
so the Mississippi basically neighbors about 17 states, not counting all of the shoots that go off it. So we get it from all the way from Missouri down to Louisiana. I know it's funny, we moved from Louisiana, but now we're back to it.
And up in Missouri, they only have the rivers. Down in Louisiana, there's lakes, there's ponds, there's partly the rivers, there's adjuncts from like the Red River, the Atchafalaya. So really, it depends on, so where we go down to Louisiana or Arkansas. Arkansas will mainly get their fish from the Mississippi. Louisiana will, those guys go in all kinds of kind of backwater. They call them ponds, but
right.
they're connected to the Mississippi by the water overflow. But when the Mississippi gets too high, they can fish in these other areas. Up in Kentucky, they've got the two big man-made lakes from the Tennessee and Cumberland Rivers.
Right.
So that's kind of naturally through there with the two dams. But the water exchange, oddly enough, doesn't allow for the growth of fish. So those waters are mainly full of small fish, not any large ones anymore. When we moved up, there were plenty of large ones. So, but down south, there's more water exchange. It's not, even though it's not stagnant, it's just a captive area. Same like in the upper Illinois, those fish can't go any further, so they congregate and become much smaller because the food source is smaller.
So we also are very mindful of water reports. I know the EPA gets a bad rap now, but some places in terms of waterways, it's still good reports that we tend to avoid anything on the Ohio River from central Kentucky, Louisville over to the east, like into West Virginia, up into Pennsylvania. And the reason is the mining has really, those waterways are really extremely high in lead and other metals that while these are filter feeder on top, we have a lot of colleagues from the University of West Virginia and such, and even they don't do research using the carp from that area. They ask us to send them the carp, our carp. So we tend to avoid fish from that area. And you'll hear, like recently, there was a report about, I think it's red algae or something like that, was killing off a lot of fish. I think it was Huntsville to Louisville. So those are in the same area because there's the bacteria is just it's just not very moving water. So we like lots of moving water, and you can tell.
Well, the fish need moving water. They won't stay in stagnant or they'll just simply die. They need to go against the current because they need water pushing stuff through their gills.
Good question.
No, but that's great, and thanks for clearing up the Mississippi.
I still believe, I have a lot of faith in the Clean Water Act, that was something that was phenomenal. There's now political movement to try to overturn some of that.
They did overturn it.
I have hope that 2020 will change that.
Okay.
I have hope.
I hear you that the Mississippi is a clean, that the river is clean. I'm just thinking about, and I'm new to the Midwest, doesn't the Ohio lead directly into the Mississippi? So is that the lead staying in the like Ohio branch of the water system? It doesn't go downriver?
It tends to be in that, in so from Louisville over to West Virginia area, it's just condensed down. It doesn't move with the current, is my understanding. So we don't really get anything from
right,
the Ohio.
So just, like,
yeah.
Not the Ohio River.
Right.
Like, you're not talking about the Ohio River.
Right.
You're talking about waterways and tributaries.
Correct.
In that.
Because the Ohio, I think, moves into the Mississippi. The question is, I think for a lot of that, you know, that doesn't just stay dissolved in the water. Some of those things are also particulate. So some of that sediments out as well, right? Process of moving down the river.
Okay,
question?
Thanks. This seems like a perfect 21st century business and wonderful all the aspects created and put together. And so a couple other comments. You did still talk way more than can be from the other side. So that's commendable. I've never been on a boat, but the Big Muddy River, we took a little boat, a small boat with a motor and a couple of little kids. And if you want entertainment, go down the Big Muddy River and watch those carp jump right into your boat, over your boat. Catch them with good gloves. It's really fun. And then my buddy was brave enough to fillet it. Does it have two spines? Or it's got a very complex bone system that makes it difficult to fillet.
Right. It's got a lot of, it's not, I call them spider bones, so it's the bone with like a branch like this.
Uh-huh.
So if you don't know how to cut, now five becomes 10. And so then you're like, they're really tiny. And you know, my favorite thing is people will say, well, if you just stick them in a pressure cooker, then the bones will just disintegrate.
Salmon.
No, they don't.
Salmon does.
Salmon it does, but not the, even a small one, the ribs, particularly the rib bones, they will stay extremely hard under extremely high temperature for a very long time. They do not disintegrate. So they have a very bizarre bone structure, but he figured out where to cut it. So then we can just use a pin bone machine puller, like they do with salmon, to pull out the pin bone. But you have to know, it's really weird. Their wide bone is really kind of an up bone, so.
So thank you so much. It's important.
Thank you.
Thank you.